Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on economic reality right after this message. Well, welcome to Tax Freedom Day, May 12th. You work all of January, February, March, April, and a third of May to pay your income tax for the year. And that's not all. Then you get to work the rest of May and all of June to pay your other withholding taxes. This income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal enterprises. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank. Now, 14 million Americans are no longer enrolled in the Social Security system, and more are opting out every day. The income tax and Social Security also violate three of the Ten Commandments. Now, you ought to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? To order your free general law CD package, just call direct 417-273-4967. Or you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, as a part of economic reality, world military spending has surged during 2003. It reached $956 billion U.S., and that's nearly half of the entire world's military budget is spent by the United States, especially for its missions in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the War on Terror, or so said a prominent European think tank. Now, the money has been effective in waging war, but threats of terror and weapons of mass destruction still exist, and some of the big offenders in weapons of mass destruction are the United States and Russia. Now, military spending rose by 11%, which the group called a remarkable increase. The amount was up 18% from 2001. The $956 billion, now it's just a tad short of $1 trillion, spent on defense costs worldwide corresponds to 2.7% of the world's gross domestic product, according to the annual report. It's very close to the Cold War peak in 1987, said SIPRI researcher Elizabeth Scones, who co-authored the report. Now, SIPRI also warned of fears that biotechnology research, particularly concerning human genes, could lead to the development of a new class of biological weapons. The free access to genetic sequence data for the human genome and a large number of other genomes, including for pathogenic microorganisms, is a great scientific resource, but it could pose a significant threat if misused, the report said. Let me pause here and make a little editorial comment. Remember, the mapping of the genome was heralded as a great advance in medical science, procuring cancer and AIDS and a whole host and plethora of other diseases. Now we find out that mapping the genome can be used for a new class of biological weapon. Remember when we first discovered the atom, we said, well, gee, we need this atom over here so that we can generate electricity. Now the Iranians are building a nuclear reactor, and they say, well, gee, we just want to generate electricity, and everybody's sitting there biting their fingernails saying, well, gosh, the byproduct of producing electricity is plutonium or uranium, enriched uranium, for which you could use it for a nuclear weapon. Can you think of anything that man has discovered that he hasn't used for war? In fact, almost all scientific discoveries are first used for war, and then if there's any kind of a spin-off or byproduct, we'll use it for that spin-off or byproduct, but it's not primarily being invented for, researched, and developed for anything other than war. And the war is designed, remember, to kill people. That's what war is all about. It's not for securing food, clothing, and shelter. It's for killing people. So when the Bible tells us that the way of peace they know not, pretty accurate statement, wouldn't you say? Mankind is out here just constantly striving for peace, aren't we? Every day you listen to some segment on the news about the United Nations and their efforts for peace. And President Bush is constantly waging war to bring about peace. And they're constantly talking about peace with the Palestinians and the Israelis. There isn't a nickel's worth of peace anywhere on planet Earth. Hasn't been for more than 100 years. There isn't going to be until the second coming is well established. Even after the second coming, there's a big war coming. Yeah, that's right. When the Messiah returns, there will be a gigantic war. We will fight him at his coming. If you think that anybody's going to welcome Jesus of Nazareth, you haven't been reading the book of Revelation, have you? And then after he returns, he's going to have to put down all of the nations of the world. So he's going to start off by going to war. Seems like war seems to be the solution for mankind's problems, isn't it? War, war, and more war. Well, I would say that if $956 billion on armaments worldwide is good, well, wouldn't $2 trillion a year be twice as good? And if twice as good is really good, can you imagine the utopia that we could create on this planet if instead of spending 2.7% of the world's gross domestic product on war, we were to double that to 5.4%, or double that to 10.8% of the total gross domestic product worldwide? Can you imagine the utopia we would have with all of those munitions, with all of those war products? Hey, listen, if mapping the genome is good for a new type of biological warfare weapon, can you imagine the peace and security that we could have? I mean, just imagine it. And these inventions, these creations are being created to make the world a better, safer place, isn't it? Isn't that what we're being told? We pay our taxes, we buy the human genome, and then we're told that this can create a new species of biological weapon to be used for what? Peace, of course. Now, researcher Richard Guthrie said that developments in mapping the human genome, which could lead to improved medicines and vaccines for heart and neurological problems, also could be used by terrorists. Terrorists. Could that be terrorists like the United States and Russia and maybe China? It is something to be concerned about, he told the Associated Press, but added that no plausible threats have been made. The United States led the world in defense spending, accounting for 47% of the total, followed by Japan with 5%, and Britain, France, and China with 4% each. The figures were in line with estimates by Jane's Information Group, a spokesman from the company's London office, told the AP. The 2003 rise in defense spending coincided with a decrease in the number of conflicts worldwide, which fell to 19, the second lowest since the think tank began issuing their reports 35 years ago. Well, see, there's the proof of it right there. All of this defense spending coincided with a decrease in the number of conflicts worldwide. There's only 19 conflicts going on. The SIPRI also noted that 14 separate peace missions began last year, the most since the end of the Cold War. That's what we need, is more peace missions. If 14 peace missions were launched last year, imagine what 28 launched this year could do for us. The report had mixed reviews about efforts to contain weapons of mass destruction. I wonder if one of these 14 peace missions could do something about Palestine and Israel. It warned that attempts to halt the proliferation of nuclear weapons were hampered last year when North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and cited Iran's apparent possession of nuclear material and information. Guthrie said those developments were offset by Libya's acknowledgement that it was developing its own nuclear program and its decision to abandon the program voluntarily. Perhaps, luckily, evidence of past and present weapons of mass destruction problems in Iran, Libya, and North Korea was strong enough to maintain the momentum of international cooperation against the proliferation menace, and many states were motivated to work for less violent solutions. Or so said Allison Bales, the think tank's director. Guthrie said that while the invasion may have served as a warning to other states with weapons of mass destruction, it could have the reverse effect in that some states may see an increase in arsenals as the only way to prevent a forced regime change. As for North Korea, Shannon Kyle, who follows nuclear issues for the think tank, said the communist country isn't likely to follow Libya's lead. Quite frankly, this cabal of elderly generals that sit around Kim Il-jong or Kim Jong-il some time ago made the same cost-benefit calculation but came up with the conclusion that the benefits of acquiring nuclear weapons outweigh not having them, said Kyle, who visited North Korea in 2002. And he added that the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in a bid to find weapons of mass destruction affected North Korea. North Korea, Kyle said, sees nuclear weapons as being very much a security guarantee. Bales said Iraq was the biggest factor of 2003. It's been an illustration of how quickly history moves these days, and many of the lessons that people initially drew from that invasion, many of the ways they thought that it would change the world, look quite different from that vantage point now, she said. The report said the March 2003 invasion highlighted the U.S. military's lethal effectiveness, but said that the post-war occupation, which has seen more than 1,000 U.S. soldiers killed in attacks by insurgents, was evident that control in Iraq remained haphazard at best. Andrew Cotney, whose report detailed the effect of the invasion and its aftermath, warned that instability in Iraq was likely to continue and could spread and bring civil war to neighboring states. Well, I understand that there's a prospect or a possibility of civil war. The experts are telling us right there in Iraq. And you got the Shiites, and you got the Sunnis, and then of course you got the people up in the north. You know, the I forgot what they were called now. You got three main factions there in Iraq. The only ones that are acting peaceably right now are those up in the north, or those Armenians, or something like that. Meanwhile, back on the farm, $956 billion a year. I'm sure that in 2004 we can top $1 trillion worldwide. Which is, you know, in the neighborhood of 2.5 to 3% of the GDP of the world. I kind of wonder, you know, with the world in need of so many other things. Oh, it's been said before that weapons could be done without, but you know, nations and civilizations and city-states can't live without weapons. I mean, if we didn't have weapons, somebody would attack us, wouldn't they? Well, hang on, we'll be back with more on economic reality when we return. So stand by, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour and The Law School, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Well, with oil prices hovering around $50 a barrel, experts have calmed frayed nerves by noting that today's services-driven American economy is much less addicted to the black stuff than yesterday's industrial economy. From 1973 to 2003, after all, the amount of oil and gas needed to create a dollar of gross domestic product fell by half. Structural changes in the economy have let the nation absorb the recent shock of rising crude oil prices, and that's the good news. Now, the bad news is that other recent structural changes in the economy, the federal government shift from surpluses to huge deficits, the national predilection for consumption over saving, and housing prices that climb faster than incomes have increased the country's reliance on another kind of fuel, and that's called credit. As a result, the American economic ship, which has weathered the recent run-up in crude oil prices, may be more vulnerable to sudden surges in the price of money. If the rate on 30-year fixed mortgages were to rise from 5.4% today to 7.5%, say next February, homeowners would get walloped. And rather than go to bed supperless than rise in debt, Benjamin Franklin wrote in Poor Richard's Almanac, he said, rather go to bed supperless than to rise in debt. Well, in recent years, American consumers, businesses, and governments have been hitting the sack with their stomachs bloated and their charge cards maxed out. From 1988 to 2000, the ratio of non-financial debt to gross domestic product held steady at about 1.8 to 1. But recently, consumer, business, and government credit has bulged like the belly of a contestant at a hot dog eating contest at Coney Island. From the beginning of 2001 to the end of 2003, the economy added $1.3 trillion in gross domestic product and about $4.2 trillion in debt. Now, that means that each new dollar of economic output was accompanied by $3.19 in new debt. So now, for the first time, the debt-to-GDP ratio stands at more than 2 to 1. Now, when you throw in financial credit, the debt that investment banks and others use to finance trading activities and the like, and total debt has more than doubled since 1994. The mere existence of huge debt needn't be a source of panic. You and I may view debt as an economic input. We borrow so we can spend and invest, and hence, as politicians like to say, grow the economy. Academic economists view it more as a byproduct. Debt is created when people, governments, and companies spend money, trade, and produce. Viewed that way, the sharp rise in credit in recent years isn't surprising or even in and of by itself alarming. When the interest rates are low, you'd expect people to pile on more debt per GDP because it's cheap, said J. Bradford DeLong. He's an economist at the University of California at Berkeley. What's more, as anyone who has ever used a mortgage calculator knows, lower debt service costs can make higher levels of debt seem eminently manageable. Here's a gigantic example. In 1997, when the total national debt stood at $5.4 trillion, Washington paid $356 billion in interest. In 2003, when the national debt grew to $6.8 trillion, Uncle Sam's interest rate, or interest bill, I should say, fell to $318 billion, actually a net savings. The environment of ultra-low interest rates engineered by Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, thus sharply muted the impact of Washington's fiscal recklessness. But the economy's apparent reliance on credit to fuel everything from home buying to the military budget is very, very troublesome. If incomes and revenues fail to rise, stressed consumers may have a tough time keeping up with payments. It's been much more a matter of households borrowing than businesses, said Benjamin M. Friedman, a Harvard economist. You have to hope that people are going to be able to service the obligations that they've taken on. An economy hooked on debt also is vulnerable to the seemingly inevitable rise in interest rates. In a period when prudence would seem to dictate locking in rates, Americans have rushed to assume greater interest rate risk. Borrowers, especially home buyers, haven't reacted to recent increases by borrowing less. In the first quarter of 2004, debt rose at an annual clip of 8.6%, more than double the growth rate of the economy as a whole. No, we've kept the interest bill down by swapping fixed rate for adjustable rate financing. The Mortgage Bankers Association reported that adjustable rate mortgages constituted 35% of new mortgages in the second quarter this year. That's up from 27% in the fourth quarter of 2003. Consumers whose maxed out credit cards generally bear floating interest rates, and the federal government, which skews its borrowing to short-term instruments, have essentially done the same thing. So if interest rates rise, we'll all have to spend more dollars on debt service, leaving fewer dollars for more productive areas and uses, like buying 90-inch flat-screen TVs. If money becomes more expensive, then we may have to downshift our spending and consumption, like drivers trading in expensive hammers for gas-sipping imports. And that may shrink the economy. Now, higher collective leverage in turn means that we're more susceptible to external shocks. The bigger the debt, the smaller the margin for error, said Austin G. Goolsbee, a University of Chicago economist. Companies with no debt can weather several lean quarters. Companies with piles of debt often find that a single bad quarter spells disaster, such as Enron, Global Crossing, and WorldCom. The same holds for consumers, all kinds of wild cards that are scary, even in placid times. Another spike in gas prices, a rupture of the housing bubble, fresh job losses, a period of sustained inflation, become nightmares during times of greater leverage. So as we go to bed with our suppers and our home equity lines of credit, Professor Goolsbee says, I think we should be a little nervous. Well, you know, here at the law school, we're not just a little nervous, we're terrified. You know, as I look at the national debt, consumer debt, I read every once in a while from the privateer, I give you a report and tell you what the world's economic condition is. And yet every night on the news, I hear the economy is growing, but the jobs are growing a little slow, but don't you worry about that. Everything's going to be gooder and gooder as we get into the new Bush administration. I said months ago, I'd be surprised if the economy could hold up until the election. It has 30 days to go, and it looks like it's going to make it. But in the process. The excesses that we have piled up over the last 50 years, especially in the last 50 years, are going to come back to bite us in the butt at some point in the future. We just don't know when, and we don't know whether it's going to be a soft landing or a hard landing. But Pete Peterson had just written a book on the economy. He used to be the Commerce Secretary back in the Nixon years. He was interviewed, I think it was on Charlie Rose the other night. And he said he's terrified. He didn't use those exact words. He was a little more guarded in his language than I am, but the essential outcome of it was, he used the terms hard landing and soft landing, and he said it didn't look good. The debt that we're piling up for our children to pay back in generations to come. Well, as we progress along, I've heard that argument used over the last 50 years. In the 1950s, they were talking about piling up debt for our children to pay back. In the 1960s and 70s, they were using the same story. Here we are in 2004 talking about piling up debt for our children to pay back. Well, our fathers didn't live within their means, we didn't live within their means, and our children are not living within their means. And there's no reason to expect that the children in the future are going to live within their means. I mean, after all, why should they be stuck with the debt? They might as well live it up while they can. So our society is a society of let's live it up. Let's burn the candle at both ends. There's no fiscal restraint. There's no moral restraint. And without some kind of restraint, then there is an ultimate end that comes to this, and it's called collapse, depression, an economic collapse. So I'm prepared as best I can, and I recommend to my students that you prepare. Remember, the Japanese, the Chinese, and everybody else in the world wants to live the American lifestyle. It's the desire of everybody. That's why 2,000 Mexicans a day cross our borders. They want to live the American lifestyle. Can't blame them. It's a lifestyle of ease and excesses. I don't think that any civilization or society has ever gone through a greater period of licentiousness and perversion than is the United States going through right now. I don't think the Romans had anything on us. the Babylonians, Assyrians, or Egyptians. I don't think that they had anything on us. And every one of these ancient civilizations collapsed. And that's just the story of history. So it would seem more prudent to me that you and I start living our lives in a more intelligent fashion. In the scripture, there's a story about Sodom and Gomorrah, and the Messiah made an observation. He said, if the people of Sodom and Gomorrah had seen what you people have seen here, what's been worked and done in front of you, what you have actually observed, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. Even with that statement of the Messiah to the people of his day concerning the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, and with that testimony today in 2004, you'd think that the people of the world today, especially the Christians, would be sitting on the edge of their seat and saying, you know, it's time for us to shape up. But I don't see any signs of that. I haven't seen any signs of that in the 50 years that I've been an observer. And I don't expect to see that. What I expect to see is that there will be more and more excesses until finally the whole thing goes upside down. It's kind of like riding on the Titanic. It was a night of excesses, of excessive speed, of excesses in every regard, and the people that were on the boat didn't have a clue as to what might happen, what could happen. It's always been a great reminder, the Titanic. Kind of reminds me of the great ship America sailing through the uncharted waters of the world today. Well, hang on, we'll be back with more on economic reality when we return right after this. Don't go away. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and the eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. Now, these two programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing, and Social Security as a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. And the income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. The income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires of us that we sign contracts with these foreign and alien gods called government in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. And Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. And Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. And then we call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it just what it is, covetousness and theft in violation of Exodus 20, verses 15 and 17. Now, you know, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that better way of life. And that's why I contend that you and I have to learn how to practice a better way than income tax and Social Security. Now, for more information about tax and status, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. And to click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, the United States and Canada have added more new millionaires in the year 2003 than Asia, Europe, and Latin America and the Middle East combined. 4 years after a stock market downturn flattened many investment portfolios, a new study finds that one of every 125 Americans is a millionaire, reflecting a growth rate not seen since the late 1990s at the peak of the stock market bubble. The 2004 World Wealth Report, compiled by brokerage firm Merrill Lynch & Company and consultancy, paints a picture of financial resurgence among the world's wealthy. The number of millionaires in the United States was up 14%, and the U.S. and Canada together added more new millionaires last year than Europe, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East combined. And most striking, the study found that the United States and Canada, the number of ultra-rich, those with investment assets of more than $30 million, has reached 30,000, about the same number of people as live in Juneau, Alaska's capital. Now, wealthy individuals in most of the world enjoyed a strong 2003, ending 2 years in the doldrums. In the U.S., rising stock markets and wealth-friendly tax cuts combined to create strong returns for the wealthy. Globally, wealthy investors, after shying from stocks in 2001 and 2002, reentered the market aggressively in 2003, expanding their exposure to 35% of their holdings from 20%. Direct investments in real estate, such as commercial real estate, and in real estate investment trusts edged up to 17% of total financial assets from 15% in 2002, according to Merrill Lynch. Although home values and prices have risen sharply in the past few years, home equity doesn't figure as part of a millionaire's holdings for the purposes of this study. But holdings in 401ks and IRAs do count. So the number of high net worth individuals in the U.S., or those with at least $1 million in financial or liquid assets, jumped to 2.27 million last year, up from 2 million in 2002. Growth in the ranks of the rich marks a sharp turnaround from 2001 and 2002, when the population of millionaires in the United States remained largely the same, and the fortunes of the wealthy declined by about $200 billion, according to the result. The report showed that high net worth individuals in the U.S. and Canada held $8.5 trillion in liquid and financial assets, up from $7.4 trillion in 2002. Now, while the wider populations of most countries are just starting to feel the effects of recovery, high net worth individuals as a group have been enjoying the fruits of recovery for the past 12 months, the report states. The report doesn't detail the sources driving growth in assets among the wealthy, although small businesses and a rising stock market have traditionally been the main drivers. Initial public offerings and the sales of small businesses, which create huge windfalls for entrepreneurs, surged in 2003. Deals expected this year, like the IPO of Google that could net its founders billions of dollars, are likely to continue the gains among the wealthy. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index rose 24% last year, while many overseas markets rose even more, accounting for much of the gains for the wealthy. Now, in the United States, the Bush tax cuts, which included a reduction in the top tax rate, as well as reductions in taxes on estates, capital gains, and dividends, also helped bolster the fortunes of the fortunate. A 2002 study by Merrill Lynch found that more than half of the high net worth individuals in the U.S. were new money, or self-made millionaires. Inherited money is declining as a share of wealth in the United States, according to the study, and accounting for less than 20% of the high net worth individuals in 2002. So despite the rise of self-made millionaires, the growing fortunes of the wealthy highlight the extent to which wealth remains concentrated among the few. Even after the huge economic gains during the bull market of the late 1990s, the wealthiest 1% in the U.S. control more than a third of the nation's wealth. That's the starkest such concentration among industrial countries. Now, a new study by Edward Wolff, a wealth expert and an economics professor at New York University, shows that while the average families made some gains in the late 90s due mainly to rising income, real estate, and stocks, the concentration of wealth held in the United States remained largely unchanged. The wealthiest 5% controlled 59.2% of the nation's wealth in 2001, little changed from the 60.3% in 1995. Now, Mr. Wolff, whose study, unlike the Merrill Lynch report, includes home ownership and says the gap between the very rich and the rest of the population probably won't close and could widen in the coming years. While the ultra-wealthy are prospering, average real wages in the United States have not kept pace. Real estate, which makes up a far bigger share of wealth for middle-class households, could take a hit with rising interest rates, and President Bush's tax cut programs disproportionately benefit those at the top of this wealth pyramid. Now, we have to be concerned about whether this latest growth is concentrated at the top, says Mr. Wolff. If it's concentrated at the top, we could see widening disparities of wealth in the population. Underscoring the concentration of wealth among the very rich, a study last fall by Arthur Kenickel of the Federal Reserve Board shows the nation's wealthiest 1% owned about $2.3 trillion in stocks, or about 53% of all individual or family-held shares. The wealthiest 1% owned 64% of bonds held by families or individuals, and 31% of total financial assets held by families or individuals, which includes everything from stocks to bonds to cash. Now, the Merrill Lynch report predicts continued good times for the wealthy around the globe in coming years, powered by rising stock markets, growth in emerging markets like China and India, and the broader economic recovery. While the number of ultra-high net worth individuals is expected to grow 7% a year during the next few years, the report says, and the total global wealth of financial millionaires is expected to hit $40.7 trillion by 2008. That's up from $28.8 trillion in 2003. And one of the biggest surprises in the report was the dominance of North America. Besides adding more new millionaires last year than any other major economic region, North America also led in the growth of total wealth. held by those with more than $1 million in assets, such as stocks, bonds, and real estate investments. The wealth held by the ultra-high net worth individuals rose to $2.5 trillion in 2005, up from $2.2 trillion in 2002. The wealth of Europe's financial millionaires rose by $300 billion, while in Asia it rose $600 billion. Now, Europe was especially weak in 2003 after topping the U.S. in 2002, although the economies of Spain and the United Kingdom, along with Sweden, perked up last year because of strong consumer demand. The lumbering giants of France and Germany weighed down European wealth creation. High unemployment, weak consumer demand, and budgetary crises left Europe with wealth and a growth of wealth of only 2.4%. The number of high net worth individuals in France grew by just 5,000. I might point out that France has a tax rate of about 60%. Some of these European socialist countries have such high taxes. Not just high taxes, they're actually confiscatory taxes. Now, in Asia, India, and China continued, or as they continued, to set the pace for the wealth creation and generation. China's voracious demand for goods helped create new millionaires throughout that region, with South Korea, Thailand, and Indonesia all benefiting. The number of high net worth individuals in Asia rose 8.4%, with 11.8% growth in China and 22% growth in India. Well, there ought to be growth there. We're exporting jobs by the millions from the United States to those regions. And the Asians picking up, I think it's 1.8 million jobs so far since 2001, and they're projected to take on another 1.5 million jobs over the next year and a half. While Americans are exporting their wealth and manufacturing across and around the world, that doesn't affect the millionaires who invest in the multinational corporations and invest in those economies around the world. Hang on, we'll be back with more on economic reality when we return. We'll be talking about natural disasters and the lifespan crisis right after this. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Natural disasters are on the rise. Four hurricanes over the past 2 months have struck Florida. When you destroy the infrastructure, you have to rebuild it. Now, that makes for business. So it's good business. I mean, after all, if we want to have a burgeoning economy, what we need to do is to destroy the infrastructure and then go back and rebuild it, and then destroy it and then go back and rebuild it. That's what we do with war. We go over to Iraq and we destroy the place, and then we let out contracts to Halliburton and Brown & Root, and we 15,000, I shouldn't just pick out Halliburton and Brown & Root, but 15,000 American companies are working in Iraq right now, reaping the benefits of that $87 billion that we American taxpayers are going to be paying. When I say we, a lot of times people will take me to task and say, well, Gordon, I thought you weren't paying that income tax, and that's true. But you can rest assured that while I'm not paying income tax for myself, I'm paying income tax for a lot of other people, and here's the way that works. Every time I buy something, the guy that sells that to me is pricing his product so that he can make a profit and pays taxes. These are called hidden taxes. We all pay those. It's kind of like property taxes and hidden taxes and sales taxes. You know, every time you go and buy something, they want to charge you 7% to spend the money that you've already paid your taxes on. So every tax that you can avoid, legally of course, is a benefit to you. But the natural disasters is a tax that you're paying, and it comes in the hidden tax category. Only we call these acts of God. You know, more and more people are being caught up in a growing number of natural disasters, a UN agency said on Friday. The International Strategy for Disaster Reduction said that the increase in numbers vulnerable to natural shocks was due partly to global warming. It said 254 million people were affected by natural hazards last year, nearly three times as many as in 1990. The assessment comes as the Caribbean and the United States are being hit by a series of devastating hurricanes. Drawn into these danger zones, these events, including earthquakes and volcanoes, floods, droughts, storms, fires, and landslides, killed about 83,000 people in 2003. That was up by about, or was up from about 53,000 deaths 13 years earlier. Now, releasing its statistics jointly with the Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters, at the University of Louvain in Belgium, and it said that there was a consistent trend over the last decade of an increasing number of people affected by these disasters. Now, there were 337 natural disasters reported in 2003. That was up from 261 in 1990. Not only is the world globally facing more potential disasters, but increasing numbers of people are becoming vulnerable to hazards, the ISDR said. The problems, that it said, are exacerbated because more and more people are living in concentrated urban areas and in slums with poor building standards and a lack of facilities. The ISDR director, Salvino Brissino, added that urban migrants tended to settle on exposed stretches of land, either on seismic faults, flooding plains, or on landslide-prone slopes. The urban concentration and effects of climate change and the environmental degradation are greatly increasing vulnerability, said, and alarmingly, this is getting worse. Let me direct your attention to two chapters in the Bible, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. And in those two chapters, somebody by the name of God, somebody that takes first-person control, first-person credit, 20 times in Leviticus 26, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob said, here's what I'm going to do to you. And not only does he say, here's what I'm going to do to you, he takes credit for it. And I don't think anybody has ever thought about global warming being a result of an intervention by God Almighty himself. No, scientists don't believe in God, so they can't say that God is creating the global warming. They have to say, well, it must be us. We have to be the ones that are doing that. And I've been doing a little science study here, and I noticed that the scientists themselves say that these are recurring cycles. After all, they have to tell us that, because that's the basis of evolutionary philosophy. It's called uniformitarianism. So when we have a Mississippi flood, like we had in 1993, they say, well, it's a 1-in-100-year flood, which tells us that while these floods don't happen every decade, they do happen once every 100 years. And then they tell us the same thing with volcanoes and hurricanes. The other day I was watching hurricanes, and I couldn't ever remember 4 hurricanes hitting the United States. And sure enough, back in 1964, 4 hurricanes struck Florida. I couldn't remember that, but the Weather Service did. And they said, now, you see, now, how can that be global warming if we had 4 hurricanes in 1964? So about every 40 or 50 years, we'll have 4 hurricanes strike the U.S., and perhaps even 4 of them will strike Florida. 40 or 50 years from now. Let's see, this is 2004. So about 2054, you people in Florida should not be surprised when 4 hurricanes strike you again. It doesn't have anything to do with global warming, does it? I mean, nobody was telling us about global warming in 1950 or 1900 or 1850. But there was a guy named God in the scripture that says, here's what I'm going to do to you. And for some reason, he selected you people in Florida for 4 hurricanes. And I suspect that one of these days, he's going to select you good people down in New Orleans for that one big one, the one that circles around behind you on Lake Pontchartrain and scores big on you. You got to think about that. Fits right in with Sodom and Gomorrah, remember? And then lifespan crisis hits supersize America. You know, bloated blue-collar Americans gorged on diets of fries and burgers, but denied their share of U.S. riches, are bringing the nation's steady rise in life expectancy to a grinding halt. 20 years ago, the United States, the richest nation on the planet, led the world's longevity league. Today, American women rank only 19th, while males can manage only 28th place, alongside men from Brunei. These startling figures are blamed by researchers on two key factors, obesity and inequality of health care. A man born in a poor area of Washington can have a life expectancy that is 40 years less than a woman in a prosperous neighborhood only a few blocks away, for example. A look at the American's health reveals astonishing inequalities in our society. State Professor Lawrence Jacobs of Minnesota University and Professor James Maroney of Brown University in Rhode Island in the journal American Prospect. Their paper is one of a recent swath of studies that have uncovered a shocking truth. America, once the home of the world's best-fed, longest-living people, is now a divided nation made up of a rich elite and a large underclass of poor, ill-fed, often obese men and women who are dying early. In another newly published paper, statisticians at Boston College reveal that in France, Japan, and Switzerland, men and women aged 65 now live several years longer than they do in the United States. Indeed, America only just scrapes above Mexico and most East European nations. This decline is astonishing given America's wealth. Not only is it Earth's richest nation, it devotes more gross domestic product, 13%, to health care, more than any other developed nation in the world. Switzerland comes in second with 10%. Britain spends 7%. As the Boston group, Alicia Manel, Robert Hatch, and James Lee point out, the richer a country is, the more resources that country can dedicate to education, medical, and other goods and services associated with great longevity. The result in every other developed country has been an unbroken rise in life expectancy since 1960, all except the United States. But this formula no longer applies to America, where life expectancy's rise has slowed but not yet stopped, because resources are now so unevenly distributed. When the Boston College Group compared men and women in America's top 10% wage bracket with those in the bottom 10%, they found that the former group earned 17 times more than the latter. In Japan, Switzerland, and Norway, this ratio was only 5-1. Jacobson Maroney said, checkups, screenings, and vaccinations save lives, improve well-being, and are shockingly uneven in America. Well-insured people get assigned hospital beds. The uninsured get patched up and sent back into the streets. For poor Americans, health service provision is little better than that in third-world nations. People die younger in Harlem than in Bangladesh, reports Jacobson Maroney. Consumption of alcohol, tobacco, and food can also have a huge impact on life expectancy. The first two factors are not involved with America's longevity crisis. Smoking and drinking are modest compared with Europe. Food consumption is a different matter, however, for the U.S. has experienced an explosion in obesity rates in the past 20 years. And as a result, 34% of all women in the U.S. are obese, compared with 4% in Japan. For men, the figures are 28% for American men who are obese, and only 2% for Japanese men. The United States obesity rates jumped in the 1980s and 1990s, and the vast majority of the population affected by obesity had not yet reached age 65. In other words, as the nation's middle-aged fatties reach retirement age, more and more will start to die out, and life expectancy in the United States could then actually go into decline. All right, these politically incorrect opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, staff, or management of the network or of this radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School at 417-273-4967. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. And for more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, I'm out of time. Once the signal says my time is up, I've got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.